This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Thursday, the 22nd of March. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dean Arcuri. Tonight on the show, we look at activism of the past and how it can influence and affect the changing narratives and approaches of young LGBTIQ activists today. As we speak with past HIV activist and screenwriting consultant, Philip Mangeau. With LGBTI narratives and characters being elevated in mainstream movies and popular culture, does our queer identity still need to be explored on the screen in the same way? Do we need queer film festivals to tell our stories? And what spaces do they provide us culturally? We ask Sarah Collins, who lives in Perth but travels to Victoria for the Melbourne Queer Film Festival every year, about that. And has RuPaul Drag Race effed up drag, or is it you? With racist hate and death threats being thrown around at the competitors online, and the fact that we're elevating an unrealistic expectation when it comes to queer commentary from people in a reality TV show, have we actually taken a show that marketed subversive queer culture to the mainstream and helped it jump the shark at the expense of our identities?
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
BPM is an award-winning movie which dramatises the story of AIDS activists in the 90s in France. It's based on the real story of communities faced with illnesses and death who took protest and direct action to the streets. Ian Muchmore caught up with past HIV activist and screenwriting consultant Philip Mangeau, who's in Australia as part of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. They discuss why a story about activism from 25 years ago engages so well with the LGBTI generations of today, who are not only passionate about advocacy and political action, but hitting a boiling point when trying to create change in a society that should be more evolved by now.
Maybe it's because we're in a quite depressed period, time, as far as politics are concerned, and young people are eager for stories of activism. And in France, for instance, we wrote the film, and at the same time, there was this great mobilization called Nuit Debout, Place de la République. Nuit Debout means nuit is night, and debout is to get up, so stay awake during the night. And we knew that writing this story, which happened 25 years ago, would document in a way the desire for politics of today's young people. I mean, politics are not there, and it's really what we wanted to show and what we wanted to tell. Activism is sexy.
This is not just a gorgeous, sexy French accent that you're listening to. The point that Philip Mangeau is making is that political activism is sexy, passionate, and emotional.
The most passionate arguments I had, and has always been, with my friends. And of course, when you write a script, you know that you're going to emphasize the passionate debates and the emotional aspect of political action. But on the other side, it's always like that. All the political groups I went to were passionate and were places for strong discussions. Let's talk about the 80s. And during the 80s, when the first cases of HIV appeared, there was this organization called AID, which really looked like what happened in New York with the GMHC, the gay mental crisis. And they did everything. They were incredible. It was a community organization. But the problem was that they were so suspicious towards the state that they would say the state will have nothing to do with our sexuality and with our death. So they did everything, but the condition was, don't talk about it. We are dealing with it. So when ACT UP was created, it was to say AIDS is a global issue, and the state and the politicians and the economic powers have to get involved in it. And to force them to get involved in it, we had to say, look, we are gay, we have got AIDS, we are going to die, we don't want to die, we are experts of our illness, of our bodies, and we are going to force you to answer. So that's what we did.
The activities of groups such as ACT UP Paris, which Philip Mongeau was part of, pushed for changes which would see an enduring change in the relationships between doctors, scientists, governments and pharmaceutical companies and those directly impacted and living with HIV. They fought for effective new drugs to save lives and tackle HIV, and for these to be trialled ethically and to be made available as quickly as possible so that lives could be saved.
The drugs company would never deal with sick people, just like doctors. I mean, they had the power, and we were sick, and we were patients. And suddenly there were those people who got AIDS. We were HIV positive, and who said, look, we are experts of our bodies, and you have to answer our questions. And we are going to steal the fire. We are going to learn, and to learn your words, and to discuss in your words. And it was so new for them. Suddenly, they had in front of them the people that they were working for, but they would never speak to us at the beginning. And suddenly they had to speak with us. At the beginning, I remember the first trials. One of the part of the people taking the drugs would take a placebo, and the other part would take the real drug. And after a few months, they would count the death. So we were against that kind of trial, and we fought a lot to redesign trials. It's one of the parts of the things we did. The other thing was that sometimes a pharmaceutical company would come and say there will be a lottery to know who is going to have the drug and who is not going to have the drug, and we were against that. So it was a considerable fight, and we had to fight every day. But on the other hand, we knew, and the big pharma knew, that fighting for their drugs was a way of saying this is an important drug. And so it was quite an impure fight, and I loved that. I loved the fact that the pharmaceutical companies understood that they needed us as much as we needed them. Going in an office and throwing away everything, trying to find everywhere the statistics that they wouldn't give us, throwing false blood on the face of people and shouting in front of the media to pressurize the drug companies. Yeah, we did that every day.
Philippe Mongeau was in the thick of these battles in the 1990s, but when effective HIV combination treatments finally became available in wealthy countries such as France and Australia, this had taken a personal and emotional toll on him. Whilst there are still significant fights globally for the rights and health of people living with HIV, everyone has their limits, and for Philippe in 2003, it was time to move on.
It used to be my fight, and it's not my fight anymore. I quit becoming an AIDS activist. I became a migrants, pro-refugees activist, and it's a different fight. I quit 14 years of my life. I became an AIDS activist in a very tragic period. And at the beginning of the year 2000, I knew that the AIDS issue was still a very important and crucial issue, but it was not as tragic as it used to be. And I was terrified by the idea that I could think, okay, those issues are not as important as the issues we had to face a few years ago. So I think when you think that, you have to leave. You have to let new people do the job, because it's their world, and my world was full of ghosts and cemeteries and hospitals, which is not exactly the way people living with AIDS live now. I've known a time where you should wake up every 2 hours to get your treatment, and I've known a time where you lived in your shit because you had diarrheas all the time as a side effect. It's not the case anymore. So, well, the main issue is how to stop the epidemic, and it's possible. I went to Sydney and I saw quite a nice poster saying, go get a treatment in the context of a PrEP, or to if you're HIV positive, and we can stop the epidemic. There's nothing in France. So many people don't know anything about that.
That was Ian Muchamore with Philip Manjot, former ACT-UP Paris activist and screenwriting consultant for the movie BPM, which is showing as part of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival this weekend and in selected cinemas around the country.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
With LGBTIQ movies winning Oscars and hitting cinemas more and more every year, what does this mean for our queer cinema? Is mainstream cinema starting to give us what we've been waiting for all along? Our lives and narratives up on the big screen? Or is it just a watered-down version of our own expression? The Melbourne Queer Film Festival is on right now and has had plenty of sold-out sessions, so there's still plenty of passion for different kinds of LGBTIQ narratives being explored on the screen. And we have found the perfect queer screen fan to share this with us. Sarah Collins lives in Perth, but for the past 10 years she's been coming to Melbourne to immerse herself in the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. The festival, now in its 28th year, showcases the finest contemporary queer cinema from Australia and beyond, and is the largest queer film festival in the Southern Hemisphere. So what is it about seeing LGBTIQ stories up on the big screen that keeps Sarah coming back?
I actually moved here for a job and became aware the festival was on, and in my first couple of years kind of dipped my toe in and then decided it was something I just needed to really commit to and get the full pass and do it all out. In general, my cinema tastes are a little eclectic. I like the sort of the out there stuff. And I think it's about, with the Queer Film Festival, it's about seeing stories that you don't see anywhere else. So I tend to see a lot of the shorts, a lot of the trans stuff, a lot of the stuff that is just not going to get a release anywhere else. Perth has a Pride Festival, and there are usually some films as part of that, but because that's not really a film festival as such, it's quite limited. Plus, I guess it works really well for me, having lived here and having friends here, to make this like my annual holiday. And a lot of my friends in Melbourne also see some films, so we meet up before and afterwards, that's not for a drink, and it just becomes a really good thing. And what I've really realised since I've been living back in Perth and coming here for the festival is that you can really immerse yourself in it when you don't have to deal with ordinary everyday things like, I have to go do grocery shopping and do my laundry and, oh, I have to go home and feed the cat. Really, my reason for being in Melbourne is to see lots of films, and everything else gets slotted around that.
When you live in a state, going to a film festival each year doesn't sound like such a big deal. But it's a different story when you live in another state. But there is something special about queer cinema that separates it from the mainstream. I asked Sarah what differences she's noticed in the storytelling of queer cinema over the 10 years when she's been coming to Victoria for MQFF.
The way it's just become so much more diverse, and there's been so many more offerings from other countries. You know, I remember when I first came, a lot of the content was American. And you actually saw, and you still see it a bit, but you would see a lot of the same actors showing up in different films. And I even remember, you know, when I first started going to see, you know, like five films in a day on the weekend, which can be a little confusing. You suddenly see an actor and go, hang on, what's he doing on screen? Didn't he die? And you're going, oh, no, that was in the other film. Whereas now that doesn't happen so much because there's such a diversity of films. And I guess you're also seeing a lot more films that have quite established actors. There are people who are known not just in queer film, which is really nice to see.
Looking at the MQFF guide or app, it can be overwhelming to decide what to go and see, but you have to start somewhere.
Really have a good read of the program and see what jumps out at you. You know, if you're just starting to dip your toe in, go for the things that are really going to, that you are fairly confident are going to be good. And then once you're in that, try and look for some things you wouldn't normally go to. So it was interesting when I first started going to the festival, it was with a very good friend of mine who lives in Melbourne and still comes to see films with me every year. But we'd go to so many films where if it was, you know, a more male-oriented film, I would be the only woman in the cinema. Or if it was a more female-oriented film, he'd be the only guy in the cinema. And I have seen some fantastic films by going to something that just sounds so like it's for a gay male audience that it might not be of any interest to me, but they've ended up being fantastic films. The last few years especially, it's been a noticeable is that, you know, you don't tend to get the audience full of women with just one guy sitting there. It's, you know, people are going to see different films. And in fact, this year, unusually for me, it's been the comedies that have really, I think, been the best films. And I went to one of the lesbian comedies, which is not a film I expect to see many guys in, and there are actually quite a few. So it's great that people are kind of looking outside their own experience. Certainly something I've always tried to do is to see as much of the trans stuff as possible, because that is more outside my experience than most of what's in the festival, I guess, and also the stuff that you just never get to see at any other time.
But we have queer films winning Oscars now, and LGBTIQ narratives are starting to appear more and more within movies, television and popular culture. But is it hitting the spot for our communities? Love, Simon hits mainstream cinemas around Australia next week, and it's screened multiple times during the Melbourne Queer Film Festival with sold-out sessions and another encore screening on Monday night. So what is it that queer cinema gives us that the mainstream cannot?
I think, again, the, you know, diversity within the films of subject matter, you know, if you look at what a mainstream idea of a queer film is, it's still quite formulaic. And the thing that's sort of different and new about it is that it's queer. You know, one of the things I noticed is that, you know, the big film that seems to have taken off the mainstream this year is Call Me By Your Name, which I saw and I thought it was a good film, but I wasn't losing my mind about it the way a lot of people seem to be. And I guess when I thought about why that might be, I thought, well, I've just seen so many queer films over the past 10 years that I'm going, this isn't a startlingly new thing. It's a good film, but it's not, you know, doing anything I think is startlingly new. Whereas some of the things I've seen when I've seen the less mainstream stuff at NQFS have just been like, wow, that's something I've never seen before.
This passion for diversity and expression when it comes to queer cinema and the narratives of our communities is something that the Melbourne Queer Film Festival program director, Spiro Economopoulos, shares with Sarah, which really sets queer cinema apart from its mainstream counterparts.
I think there is something really powerful about seeing yourself and your story represented on the big screen. There's something that, as much as, you know, we constantly talk about the fact that we see queer characters in the mainstream quite a bit now on television and, you know, coming up more in the cinema, there's still something really potent and palatable about seeing yourself represented. It's really important, and I think it never gets old, actually. I think there is something that really draws you to watching yourself, and there are so many stories out there to tell. So I think it's really important to have something like the Queer Film Festival here. And it's an incredible community experience as well. So I think it's very different from other festivals where this is actually like a shared experience that's not just about sitting there on your own watching a film. It gives you a perspective on different people's lives. I think it's really important to see alternative voices. I think it's important to have experiences that aren't just your own. And I think these experiences give you empathy into other people's lives, which is always, you know, a really important thing.
That was Melbourne Queer Film Festival program director Spiro Economopoulos and Sarah Collins, who travels every year from Perth to Melbourne to watch queer cinema with members of her community and friends exploring our stories on the screen. While this weekend is the final weekend of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival this year, they announced yesterday their films for their Monday night encore and surprise screening, so why not head to the MQFF website to check it out? Remember, queer cinema happens all over the country. This year, MQFF are heading to Alice Springs from April 6th to 8th, and the Bendigo Queer Film Festival is taking place on the 27th to 29th of April. Outside of the yearly Mardi Gras Film Festival, which is in February every year, Queer Screen stages a second season of LGBTI films in September, so be sure to check them out on social media. And while Brisbane's Queer Film Festival at New Farm Cinema just finished, it'll be back next year in March. With screenings of LGBTIQ films telling our stories all around the country, what are you waiting for? Check out some queer cinema today.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Has RuPaul Drag Race effed up drag, or is it you? With its 10th season hitting the airwaves tomorrow, it's time for us to take a good hard look at how a reality TV show that marketed subversive queer culture to the mainstream has changed how we express ourselves within our queer culture and identity. With queens in the latest season receiving death threats and racist abuse online from fans, are we taking our expression too far at the cost of our culture and community? Or is this achieving problems with a new space of queer drag expression ready to break through? Squirrel Friends, Nick Hollis, the co-founder of the Institute of Many and also Australia's most widely read drag race commentator via junkie.com, Matthew Wade, editor of Star Observer and superfan of drag race, and Frock Hudson, the queer alter ego of The Informer's executive producer and cabaret comedian Dean Arcuri, that's me, delved into this as we look at who is really causing the problem when it comes to RuPaul's Drag Race.
Drag Race is at the point of fandom now where it is a true global Western pop cultural phenomenon, and the fandom isn't always has been so tribal because it's a competition, and these queens go from the competition into the fandom, and it stays really, really competitive even after you leave the show. So with All Stars, when you come back, you're bringing your fandom back, or your lack of fandom, or your enemies, and that creates a real hot pot of tension.
It creates an interesting space for the dialogues that we have about Drag Race. I mean, if we look at it 10 years ago, season one was very small, was a very different type of show. It was a little bit more America's Next Top Model. And it certainly has continued to evolve over the last 10 years into this juggernaut of what seems like queer expression, but it isn't necessarily the case. And it's the way in which our community have chosen to use it as a sense of identity that I think is creating, now in its 10th year, a lot of confusion.
Yeah, well, it's a testament to how big it's grown, obviously, over the last decade. I mean, the fact that, I mean, not to jump ahead, but the upcoming season, you know, before it's even aired, a lot of the queens are already getting tens of thousands of followers that maybe they didn't have previously. And I think what Nick said was quite accurate, which was, you know, with All Stars, it's different again because, yeah, all of the fans are kind of heading into the series with preset ideas of how their favourite queen is going to compete in the show and what's going to happen and expectations. And I guess when those expectations aren't necessarily met, that's where the
residual resentment.
Yes.
One of my favourite phrases.
But that's even the case here. With, if we look at it, season 10, which is starting this week, people already have their favourites.
Mm.
The minute the queens are announced, everyone is jumping online and picking who they think has the best face, who they think has this.
Who's going home first?
Everyone has their opinions. I think it creates a really destructive space for our drag culture because of where we choose to hang our hats.
Oh, I think any large-scale cultural product is going to create heated and toxic debate online. And eventually, what the lesson, I think, for a lot of drag race queens is that they are not famous until they go on the show, and they've got to learn really quickly to ignore what happens, you know, under the fold or in the comment section, so to speak. So I think that's a big journey they all go on, and we've seen examples of their health and well-being and mental health, like Cartier probably most famously, just, you know, is only back now after a break. And, you know, these people weren't famous beforehand, and it has an effect on them.
But it does also look at how we glorify them within the media.
I'm not here to be your friend, I'm here to win $100,000 and be the next
competition. Okay. I get along with them, and clearly I don't get along with you.
That's fine. I don't have to be your friend to win this show. This is not RuPaul's best friend,
Sherlock.
Well, the competition itself, like, it's not dissimilar to a sporting environment in a way, I guess, because people have their teams or queen that they root for. I guess the difference between RuPaul's Drag Race and, say, football is that whereas on football, yeah, that can be a very toxic environment as well. You know, people want to attack this football team or that football team, but the difference is these are actual individual people. It's not like they're saying, oh, I hate this team. They're actually saying, Trixie Mattel or Shangela, I hate you. Like, you suck because you did better than the person I was rooting for. So it's a lot more pointed and targeted attacks.
I think so. But, you know, it is what it is. This is RuPaul's Drag Race. It's a cultural product. It's totally a late capitalist nightmare in many in many ways. And you know what you're signing up for. Mm. This is the thing. This isn't some sort of, you know, rags to riches story. Like, it's pretty clear what you're in for if you are one of the thousands and thousands of people, you know, who are vying for it, who get selected into that top 12. Well, it's like winning the lottery.
Totally. Mm. Well, now that's what it is. But yeah, when it started, there was a more selective process. There was more aim to be elevated a winner. But after 10 years, with this many queens coming through every single season, can we really now say it is the Olympic of drags, or is it a little bit more of a production line?
I don't have a sugar daddy. I've never had a sugar daddy. If I wanted a sugar daddy, yes, I probably could go out and get one, because I am what? Sickening. You could never have a sugar daddy because you are not that kind of girl. Baby, everything I've had, I've worked for and I've gotten myself. I built myself from the ground up.
Consistently each season, and even most recently with All Stars, you know, you see a lot of queens come out and kind of they'll try to speak out against that kind of bullying behavior, and they say, you know, just treat all the queens, support their work, even if they're not your favorite, you know, still have, be kind, be compassionate. But we still obviously time and again see that kind of negative and toxic culture around it. Maybe I'm throwing a question out to you guys, but like, how do you think that we can actually shift that to make it a bit more supportive? I mean, obviously you're always going to have your favorites and you're maybe going to dislike other ones, but some of that really, I guess, racist or really kind of horrible abuse that gets perpetrated online, I mean,
I think that's a really important point, is how you conduct yourself as a fan in the online community reflects how you conduct yourself as part of the LGBTIQA community. So if you're throwing racist barbs around towards Drag Race queens, well, then clearly you're a racist. So and you know what, that's going to present problems for how you interact with the rest of the community. If, say, for example, you are a cisgendered gay man who has a problem with trans people, like some particular very famous drag queens, you know, that's going to present some problems. So, you know, we need to move the whole community forward, but also remembering that, you know, RuPaul's not Jesus. This is not the second coming. This is a TV show that is actually a pantomime when it comes down to it. And we like throwing fruit and vegetables at the performers.
It has a Shakespearean part to it, doesn't it? We are in the galley.
When they're on stage, and by that I mean the TV show, they're all playing a part. You know, I still think about the great Barneys on the show, you know, Fifi versus Sharon, Roxy versus Jinx. Like, those are the kind of golden era fights in
Dynasty
the show.
Dynasty type fights.
Yeah, totally. No, absolutely. And I look back now and I watch them again and again and again because I'm obsessed. And Roxy, for example, I loathed Roxy in season 5. I think she was an absolute bully and a total see you next Tuesday.
And acknowledges that.
And then acknowledges that. And then I go back and I watch All Stars 2. And even though I remember being so frustrated that she kept getting saved week after week by Alaska and Detox, etc., you know, I look back and watch All Stars 2 now and, you know, she managed to redeem herself so that when I rewatch even her toxic behavior in season 5, I don't feel the same level of vitriol I did for her as a character. Now, the difference there is that you don't jump on Twitter and keep atting her today, going, you're so mean to Jinx, I hate you.
Exactly. It's like,
that was 5 years ago.
In a world full of nines, be a 10.
That was Nick Hollis, Matthew Wade and Frog Hudson discussing how RuPaul's Drag Race has changed over the past 10 years to a point where it's time for queer culture to think about the spaces that they're reacting within when it comes to the narrative towards the show. That conversation was part of a longer podcast which will be available via Joy's website from tomorrow, called Hey Kitty Girl, where Joysters will be reviewing episodes of Drag Race every week, as well as exploring the show and our drag culture and identity today.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you the news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI community. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter.
If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Dean Arcuri.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.